New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello, I'm Christopher Naughton. I'm happy to be working alongside longtime host Jeffrey Mishlove and co-host Emmy Vadnais and all the other great guest hosts here at New Thinking Aloud. Quick note right here at the top, please click on like, comment, subscribe, ring the bell. It helps get programs like these out to people like you. Well, what must it be like to teach a course on ufology at a Midwestern college, especially if it's a conservative Catholic college? My guest today is Dr. James Madden. He has taught at Benedictine College in Kansas since 2003, and he's written a number of books, Mind, Matter, and Nature, a Thomistic Proposal for the Philosophy of Mind. And his latest is Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, UFOs, Philosophy, and the End of the World. He joins us today from his family home in Atchison, Kansas. Dr. James Madden, Jim, if I might, welcome to New Thinking Aloud. Great having you here today. I know you're coming to us from Benedictine College in Kansas. And I have to tell you, it's probably one of the last places on earth I might have seen a professor teaching a course on UFOlogy.
Yeah, it sort of surprised me too when I found myself last year teaching a course on the UFO. It wasn't what I set out in my career to do. And you know, I think one discovers new things to think about, you know, throughout, hopefully. And, you know, for me, it's been part of like the continual life of learning process to be open to this kind of thing.
So I take it you were raised Catholic, like myself?
Yeah, I was raised Catholic. You know, through undergrad, all but one year I was in Catholic schools, mm-hmm. right? So I've been in the Catholic world for, you know, most of my education and most of my career.
Wow. Yeah. And this is not something that they taught in catechism.
No, you did not hear much from the UFO.
So let me ask you, come upon this and how did it jive? Because I really, you know, part of what fascinates me about what you've been doing and Diana Posolka and others, Matthew Roberts, is where they have come from philosophically, religiously, and how they got to where they are today. Speaking with Matthew Roberts, again, who was in the Encounter series, he was an atheist most of his life. So something comes upon him and his entire worldview changes. What happened to you? What was the major world change where maybe you were dyed-in-the-wool Catholic and all of a sudden something comes into your life and you're thinking, maybe I'm not a stereotypical or orthodox Catholic?
Yeah, it was, you know, you have to remember also that I'm a professor of philosophy. Okay. And I was, you know, like the one constant in my life since I was 18 has been philosophy. Okay. And so for me, open-ended, no holds barred inquiry has been a commitment of mine as long as I've been capable of making real commitments. So for me, you know, so I was not interested in the UFO until after 2017, when a lot of people, you know, after the New York Times articles and some of the government admissions about it, all right, I was not really interested in it until that point. For me, it was, you know, it was never something I had a view on either way. I wouldn't rule it out. I wouldn't rule it in. But then with those revelations, it was something I thought, wow, this might be worth looking into in a scholarly way. I began to read. And it resonated with other work I was doing. So I've always, you know, for the last couple of decades, I've worked in philosophy of mind, cognitive science, rationality of religious belief. And the UFO dovetailed with those issues very interestingly. Okay. So for me, getting into the UFO wasn't sort of a radical worldview change. It was an extension of scholarly intellectual paths that I was already on, although it took me outside of the typical lane of an academic, you know, teaching at a liberal arts college in the Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, it took you outside the lane of perhaps most colleges and most universities, but let alone a Catholic university.
So my master's thesis advisor back at Kent State was a pretty colorful guy. And he liked to refer to some philosophers as being ontologically promiscuous, okay, meaning they would recognize all sorts of entities and let them into their theories, okay? And I think one of the things that has helped here, especially in my teaching, is Catholics are already rather ontologically promiscuous, okay? So, and here's what I mean by that is, the first time I taught a course on this, the students didn't really know what they were getting into. It was listed as a philosophy and religion course, and the course description gave me broad latitude to kind of do what I wanted to. And so when they got into a course on the UFO, a lot of them were pretty shocked, pretty scandalized. But then I pointed out to them, like, look, you're mostly very conservative Catholics. You believe in a lot of weird stuff already. You believe in all sorts of miracles. You believe in all sorts of appearances, et cetera, et cetera. So I think in some way, okay, you do have the orthodoxy issue, but I also think there's a kind of openness to the odd and the supernatural that you have, especially in a Catholic environment. So I think that actually has helped, okay, because I'm already dealing with people who are in no position to rule anybody out for making claims contrary to the mainstream materialist paradigm, okay? Now, the UFO is ill-behaved with respect to Catholic orthodoxy, and that can provide its own problems. But I do think it doesn't surprise me that people who are already on the fringe of academia, because we don't operate in the mainstream materialist reductive paradigm, that we're what people getting into this and that we're at institutions where there's some latitude to do that. I mean, I think I might have more likely been shut down if I had been at a very, very hardcore secular institution, right? And I think maybe you've experienced some of that in your own work, yeah.
Yeah, or maybe you're at an evangelical institution, but maybe you're right. Maybe the Catholic background in mysticism, perhaps looking at some of the saints and the great mystics. Again, perhaps in my Catholic upbringing, I might have appreciated being introduced to Meister Eckhart or Thomas Merton or even more recently, right, Pierre Chardin. But right, these are all great Catholic mystics who, by the way, have not garnered sainthood, and perhaps they should be considered at one point in time because maybe they were so ecumenical. In some ways, Catholicism and Christianity, which has been so fundamental and so monotheistic, it has not often wanted to look outside its own borders. It didn't even want to look at Islam. It didn't even want to look at Buddhism. When Thomas Merton came along, you know, some people to this day, Matthew Fox, for example, a former Catholic priest, believe that, you know, he was murdered in Vietnam because of his ecumenical beliefs. Getting outside of any kind of monotheism or evangelicalism is truly astounding. And again, I would say hopeful.
I agree. Now, so far. So, you know, we'll see how far these conversations are going to be fostered and that sort of thing. And, you know, another important part of this, especially my particular take on the UFO as such, is mainly, you know, what it's giving us a sense of the absolute human limitations in terms of cognition, in terms of perception. And I think the only way to make sense of it is in terms of the limitations of human sense making. Okay. And I think it's difficult to look at, and I'm in just using the UFO as an example, but I think other phenomena that are in the wheelhouse of your show and the audience, but looking at all these things, I think that the big message to take away is there's so much more we don't know about the world than we do, and that these sort of phenomena awaken us from those dogmatic slumbers, right? Which, once again, it can be good for Orthodox religion, okay, in two senses. One, it affirms its own access to the supernatural, as it were. Mm-hmm. And also it can also force us to be more supple, to force us to look in directions that we wouldn't have otherwise looked.
We're starting to find that this is not something so far out there that we can't at least discuss it. So maybe it is time to bring it into a religious discussion. And that's what you and Diana Pasulka and many others, Jeffrey Kripal, have done. You're bringing this into the realm of religion. Is UFOlogy in some ways becoming a religion of sorts?
Well, I mean, that's certainly part of Diana's work, okay? And she's going to be very careful that she won't say it's a religion per se, because she has a very technical view of what a religion is, because she is a scholar of religious studies. But she will say it is something like a spiritual movement. It is something that functions much like a religion. Okay. And, you know, once again, that to make that determination, that's a little beyond what I do. But I do think that she's very much right about that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, but also I think then, and this is where, you know, there is more of a philosophical worry, is that then means the same sorts of concerns we might have about religion should also now apply to the UFO. And here's what I mean is, we do know that human beings can go very wrong religious. We do know that religion can unhinge human beings from contact with the real, right? That religion doesn't have to go well. It can be a source of manipulation. That there is something to the Nietzschean, Freudian, Marxist critiques of religion. Okay. Those what some people call the hermeneutics of suspicion. All right. And ufology, if indeed it does take on a religious or a spiritual guise, then we have to subject it to that. We have to hold it up to the mistrust that is deserving what might be the power plays involved. Okay. And I think that's one of the key messages in American Cosmic, Diana's first book on this topic. But it's also a message that I think goes very much unemphasized by people's reaction to it. That people, you don't hear the ufologists talking quite so much about the myriad of ways that Diana shows you in that book that our religious views can be manipulated and it can be subverted, right? And the UFO is no exception to that. Okay. And I think we do, yes, there is a religious aspect to it for good and for ill. And we have to open to both parts of it.
Yeah, because again, as this has entered much more of the mainstream, it has become much more acceptable now, especially I'd say in the last decade, maybe the History Channel has a lot to do with that. The main question has been, who are they? What is their craft like? Where are they from? And, getting a sense from reading your latest book, I almost feel you're saying that's really not the big question we should be asking ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not claiming to be the innovator on that. I mean, if you look at already John Keel, one of the deans of ufology, in his book Operation Trojan Horse, in 1970, is already at that point saying, the story about it is that it's aliens from other planet. The story is about it is that it's aliens from other planets. But yet, he's already citing people that were writing in the 1950s who are saying it's not that at all. It's much weirder than that. That seems to be a narrative that's being imposed on this thing. Maybe for, Cold War psyop reasons, maybe just because it's easy to manage or what have you. Choose your conspiracy theory, but I think at this point, we have to have one. Okay. And so I'm, and for reasons that we talked about earlier, I'm mistrustful of any attempt to positively interpret what it is. Okay. I'm only interested in looking at, how we can position ourselves with respect to it and give you an account of why we wouldn't be surprised that we're surprised in this way. Because it seems at this point, the waters are so muddied over what is information, what is disinformation, what is the hangover from our popular culture, that I don't know that we're in any position yet to make positive judgments about it.
One of the things that people want to know desperately is, aside from who are they, where they're from, is are they good or bad? And again, we get to, whether reading Whitley Strieber or our Matthew Roberts interview recently, you get this wide discourse of what this phenomena is. But again, I think you're asking us to rethink what the UFO phenomena is. You're asking us to look at the big picture. What does it symbolize? What does the myth symbolize?
Right. And let's go to are these entities good or bad? Okay. One possible way of thinking about the phenomena, and one that goes, I think, underappreciated, is, this could be just some other earthly type of organism, okay, that for whatever reason we have not often run into in our history until relatively recently, because, we've begun to fly to places we haven't flown before, or listening to things we haven't listened to before, what have you. And it could be that we're just bumping into something else that has inhabited the earth as long as we have or longer. Okay. And would that be good or evil? Well, is a rattlesnake good or evil? Is a bear good or evil? Well, no, it's just doing what rattlesnakes do. Mm-hmm. It's just doing what bears do. Mm-hmm. So there could be very, literally mundane explanations of this. All right. It's another kind of organism from the earth, in which case, the to look for it to be good or evil, I think, would be the wrong kind of question to ask. Okay. Now, but also, it does seem that people's encounters with these phenomena do have, carry with them highly symbolic content. I mean, I think the people coming back from these experiences, they come back with information. Information sometimes doesn't make sense. Sometimes it does make sense. And it does seem, though, that whatever this is, it does attempt to relate to us cognitively. It seems to be trying to tell us something. Now, whether it's deceptive in that way, a la Jacques Vallée, or some things he's worried about, or that it's trying to help us out, we don't know. Okay, so but it does seem the only thing we can go on at this point, at least for laymen like you and me who don't have access to the literal videos and things like that, it's an interpretive act. Like, what is the symbolism of this? What might this thing be trying to tell us? Okay. I think it's interesting that it does seem to take off, so to speak, for us after the Second World War in the wake of the use of atomic weapons. It does seem to take off for us as we look at things like climate change and our acerbic politics. Okay. And it's interesting that we do have a sense of seeing these things at a time that we all feel that the end of some era is happening and the beginning of something new is happening. Okay. I don't think that's accidental to it. Now, whether that's because it's our psychological projection from the anxiety of an end of an era or because something's helping us through it, I wouldn't claim to know that.
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't think anyone can claim that. But I do think we have to look at the actual symbolic content that we're being given here.
Right. So maybe their very presence is associated with our own modern crises that we're going through, even if it was self-created. You know, it's interesting. Ever since I've been working with Jeff and Emmy here and New Thinking Aloud, I've always had interest in the esoteric. I mean, whether it was reincarnation, near-death experience, out-of-body experiences, psychokinesis, etc. I'm just a stone's throw from the Edgar Cayce Association for Research and Enlightenment here in Virginia Beach. And this man was a psychic giant. He was the most documented psychic in American history. But what I've come to find out, or at least I've been exposed to, is that UFOlogy and the UFO UAP phenomena is part of the psi continuum. NDEs, reincarnations, OOBs, psychic kinesis, UFOs. And in some ways, this dawning of this new awareness, to me, signifies the end of fundamentalism. So maybe even going back to what we were talking about before in Catholic and Christians, do you see this phenomena, whatever it might be, as being a signet, as being a sign of the death of fundamentalism on the planet, or the potential of being the death of fundamentalism?
Maybe that's our hope.
Yeah.
So, this does go back to another theme, but I think it's worth going back to, is, you know, let's take, for instance, Jacques Vallée's Invisible College, the classic of ufology. Mm-hmm. And I still think the real canonical piece in ufology. Vallée in there does a comparative study between some of the Marian apparitions in the Catholic tradition, both Lourdes and Fatima, and some of the standard UFO experiences. And he shows how, at a basic first-order perceptual phenomenological level, they seem very similar.
Yeah.
Okay. But now you have two different interpretations of that same phenomenon.
Yeah. Okay?
And now, a religious believer, a Catholic might say, oh, it turns out the UFOs are actually, you know, the Blessed Mother or angels or demons, okay? Or a UFO, someone into the UFO lore may say, oh, it turns out the Marian apparitions or, you know, traditional claims about angels and demons are the UFO, okay? But those kinds of identity claims are sticky. They're difficult. You know, is water H2O or is H2O water? Okay, it depends on what our broader theory is, okay? You know, is heat molecular motion or is molecular motion heat? Well, you know, it depends on what's the more broadly explanatory theory. So it seems like there's, to make those kinds of claims, we have to look at where the better founded and broader explanation is. And it could turn out to be neither, right? That there's some third thing here that is showing up and is being interpreted in these two ways, okay? Now, to take us back to your point about fundamentalism, I think it's that two-edged sword I talked about, like the UFO, well, for religion with respect to the UFO.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'd say this for any of the paranormal phenomena. On the one hand, it does re-enchant nature. There's something out there. There's something weird out there that doesn't fit the standard materialist paradigm, okay? But it's ill-behaved with respect to orthodoxy. It doesn't only appear in situations that are easily interpreted in terms of anybody's orthodox. Okay. So that it seems to be that it doesn't spell against religion per se, but it does spell against fundamentalist religion. It does spell against the ability to say, like, oh, this particular mythological tradition is the right one.
Yes.
When you have well-grounded phenomena, right, showing up in other traditions that appear to them as under their own mythological descriptions. Okay. So I don't think it's bad news per se for our sense of supernature, but I do think it makes difficulties for thinking of any one take on this being exclusively correct.
Not to be coy about this, but I mean, there's still a large portion of our population that, you know, believes that Jesus is the only way. They would probably teach that in most Catholic schools and in most Catholic churches, certainly in evangelical churches. And, you know, if an alien were to land among us, would we have to start insisting that he has to believe in Jesus too to get to heaven?
Yeah. I mean, very often, I think most of the discourse about, once again, just using the UFO as an example, about the UFO within believing Christian circles is, well, you know, if the aliens land on the White House lawn, should we baptize them? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think that misses the point. Okay. Because mm-hmm. if in fact we're confronting something like this, it turns out reality is weirder than even all of our religions predict. Okay. You know, people like to talk about ontological shock. You hear that term quite a bit in mm-hmm. the UFO world. But I don't think it's used by people who are really open to sort of serious ontological shock. It's always, well, they think of the UFO in terms of this lore that's been handed down to us that kind of fits more or less how we think about the world. Like, we think of, like, the aliens as, you know, bipedal, animals like ourselves, right? And it's they're different, but they fit our categories, okay? But it looks like what we're dealing with here is something that just doesn't fit any of our categories very well at all. Okay. And so I think the standard religious questions about it are going to miss the point. The same way I think the standard scientific questions about it miss the point.
It's going to have significant consequences on whatever our theory of everything is.
Exactly. And even the basic categories that we group things into, it seems like there's a kind of thing in our vicinity that doesn't fit our normal ways of package effects.
This work is not for the faint of heart, is it?
No, I don't think it is, yeah.
So let me ask you, as a practical matter, you're a teacher of philosophy, mm-hmm. and I understand, you know, that's, you're giving us the big synoptic view of the world and what things mean to each other and how they all fit in. But we live in an everyday world. How does the recent trends in UFOlogy that you've studied, and you've written about, and others have written about, how is that impacting us culturally? How is that impacting us politically? You know, we're in this massive polarized world right now. We know that in this big election season, for example, the United States has not been this polarized probably since the Civil War. You know, someone might say, well, you know, UFOs are going to do what they do. They're here, they're there. They've been here for 50 or 60 years. So what? You know, we don't know what they are. We don't know if they're real, what have you. But what impact does something like this have on our society, on our culture, on our political beliefs? How will that impact us going into this most polarized of all seasons?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. And I think that's a question that isn't often asked. In fact, I think you're the first one I've heard ask it. Seriously. There was a paper published in the early 2000s, and forgive my shiny scholarship, because I'm going to forget the author's name. It was one of the first papers in the humanities and social sciences that I found that was taking the UFO seriously. And it was published by a couple of political scientists. And they both had thought, they had come to the conclusion that the evidence for the UFO was actually rather very good. But they found it curious that it was still a completely forbidden discourse in academia, in government, you know, in the military. And they wondered why. Well, their view is that all of our political institutions have a sort of humanistic presupposition. Like the assumption is that the reigning sovereign power on the earth is human. Okay. And even if there's a theistic religious backdrop, it's always that, but the human is the top of the chain as ordained by God. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so all of our politics assumes that, you know, if we can just sort out who's top dog among the humans, we can sort out the most reasonable political allegiance. Okay. And these authors argued that if indeed there's another intelligence on the earth, okay, either from here or somewhere else, that is not human, but also is more powerful, more technologically advanced than all of us, then it would seem that would completely mess up, as it were, our basic power structures and notion of sovereignty. Immediately, there would be a race to ally yourself, human nature would want to ally itself with this other sovereign power as a matter of self-interest. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, their argument was the UFO has to be suppressed politically because because the reigning powers will not be able to maintain, you know, their exclusive sovereignty over us and if that information gets out. Okay. So interesting thesis. Let's grant it just for the sake of argument.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Suppose they're correct. Mm. But now what do we have? We have from within the power structure in the United States movements to sort of come forward with this information. Okay. Why would that be? You know, why would the sovereign power want to undermine itself? Well, of course, there could be, and maybe it looks like there is, there's no unanimity about what's shooting down this information from the people who hold it. There seems to be struggle going on there. But why would somebody want to let it out? Well, could it be that someone wants to let this out because they realize that our politics is over, right? There is no universal allegiance to any human power now, that we're losing our ability to actually have political discourse. And maybe it's that there needs to be a political reset done, and maybe the best way to do that is to admit we have never been in charge of this thing, right? Well, or that there's someone else out there that is in charge of this thing.
Well, and maybe that's why politicians have, along with other government officials, have tried to suppress this information. They can't handle it. It's going to unearth everything. All of our institutions are going to topple. They seem to be on solid ground these days much. Yeah. Anyway,
and this could be the Hail Mary pass to save something like a coherent politics.
Yeah, in some ways, to keep suppressing it, right? We just keep
or maybe by letting it out.
Okay.
There could be something we could all get around again.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
You see what I mean? Because the question is like, why now? Why? Something I ask myself all the time is, why now? Why is it being let out now? Right? Now, some people have views, like Diana has a view that, look, it's got to be let out because more people are going to space, more people have surveillance equipment, that people are noticing things out of this. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's it. The technology is in everybody's hands now that we can take pictures of things. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's it. I wonder, though, if maybe it has something to do with the very issue that you're raising, is that our notion of popular sovereignty has been so eroded, okay, that there is no political institution that anyone is really aligned with. And maybe it's time to let the cat out of the bag, because maybe that's the only thing that now we could become aligned to.
It's interesting. I was just speaking with Mitch Horowitz, who wrote the great book, Occult America, and he's just written on modern occultism recently. And we got towards the end of our conversation, and he said, you know, Chris, because we were talking about 2024 and the political polarization, et cetera. He said, the only bipartisan issue I'm seeing these days is the UAP-UFO phenomenon, where you're getting, and actually right now it's being carried a lot more like on News Nation, which is one of those not also RANs, but a smaller CNN or MSNBC or Fox News out there. And, you know, they've got Avi Loeb on, and they've got Alvarez and many others, Dr. Greer, et cetera. You know, people that maybe we might, you know, hear or see about on this channel and some other associated channels. But now we're starting to see it in the mainstream. Again, it can't be suppressed so much. So you're right. It might simply be the time is now. And the time is now, because it may be one of the very few bipartisan issues. As Mitch was saying, it's almost a word from the past, bipartisan. And yet you would like to think perhaps things such as climate change and maybe the UAP phenomena would be something that would cut across the aisles.
Yep. I mean, and maybe that's the play. Maybe that's the play. I don't know. I mean, I always like to point out, I have no insider info at all. I'm just a armchair thinker, but what I see, I think one of the important data that need to be accounted for in this is, why now? Why suddenly is this change being made in terms of openness, even if the openness is contested?
You know, I'd like to go back to, you know, talking a little bit about government suppression and our political institutions. I go back to that interesting, the Phoenix Lights story back in 1997, mm-hmm. where, you know, lots and lots of people in the Phoenix area saw a multitude of lights. And here comes the governor of Arizona at the time, comes out with, a humanoid alien doll, and he's mocking it and he's ridiculing it. And 10 years later, he's coming out saying, well, actually, I saw it too.
That he had seen the lights himself, and he believed that they were from an extraterrestrial source.
No, I'm serious. I'm serious now. That unquestionably it was a UFO.
And there's something even similar of what happened in Zimbabwe. I know you're familiar with Encounters because, again, right. Diana Pasulka wrote the book, and they made Steven Spielberg and Amblin made a 6-part series on it.
It's there because you're interacting with it. Things in culture and spirituality.
I believe in it because I did see it.
And then I saw the being less than, a meter or two away from me.
Like a door.
And then suddenly he was over there. And he was right in front of us.
Same sort of thing where a school teacher, you know, sees something, she doesn't say anything, and then years later she has a visitation. I mean, I don't know what kind of a comment that is, other than the fact that maybe there's just a part of us that doesn't want to believe it, doesn't want to upset the apple cart. And really we're being told the lenses that you've been looking through for most of your life are no longer sufficient.
The people I've met who have had these experiences, they all tell you that, you know, I don't have... Any way I talk about it seems to do it more violence than it does to actually articulate it. Okay. Imagine having that kind of experience. Think of the forces in within yourself that just wouldn't want to deal with that, let alone having to go back and say, use the example of a school teacher, to go back and what are you going to tell your kindergarten class about this? You know, you can't. Do you know what I mean? So I understand the pressures on people, or say the governor of Arizona. I mean, he has to run a state, and you know, he can't just stand up in front of the state and say, hey kids, turns out everything we thought about the world is just wrong. I'm not coming out for people lying, but I do understand the how would you even begin to articulate this to a populace? Okay. And this is maybe something that has to be done over 70 or 80 years of slow drip to the popular culture or something like that. And I think the idea that the way this should go is just that at some point somebody just, you know, makes a Twitter post outlining everything that's happened behind this. I think that's naive, but how it could possibly work?
You know, you say in your book that most of the discourse in the UFO community has been about disclosure, transparency, governments, whistleblower revelations. But it's interesting that any answer that would actually make sense to us, you know, at least in our current state, could only ever be a lie.
How do we tell the truth about something that we're not designed to even talk about, right? And that's why I think the level of skepticism that if there are UFOs, okay, or if there are things that show up that are outside of our ordinary purview, if that is in fact the case, I think we have to understand the implication for that is not primarily, oh, there's aliens here who are going to enslave us. It's that, what else don't we know about the world? Like, what else have we been systematically deceiving ourselves about?
Let's say the next president or two presidents from now, you know, comes out and says, you know, we have been lying all along. In fact, I've been lied to, and our former presidents have been lied to, and perhaps the national security state had a lot of this information. But let's say we do come across or is disclosed that not only are UFOs quote-unquote real, but by the way, we have some of their technology. By the way, we have some of their biology. Now what happens? What does that look like? What's the impact on the population at that time? And I know we're just kind of, throwing things against the wall here, but I'm going to lean on the philosopher to give us some insights.
Yeah. So my wife is a psychologist, and she often kids me that I operate under the mistaken assumption that most people are philosophers. Okay. So if that happened, I would want to do nothing but sit around and think about it. Okay. You know, I would want to do nothing but think about it, teach about it, come on here and talk to Christopher about it. You're similar. Okay. It would be the biggest thing. Okay. It already is, because what are you doing? You're already spending your time thinking and worrying about this and many other interesting things. Okay. I wonder, though. I mean, I do think my wife has a point that people like us might miss how rare in the population people like us are. You know, I wonder to what degree, especially given our current, you know, like deeply distracted and stultified and ill-educated population, like how many people would just, you know, what's on the next channel? And maybe that's been the point of like the slow drip and playing with the popular imagination on it, is I wonder how big of a difference it really would make to the average, you know, citizen out there. Because we seem to live in a culture that sort of conspires against concern, that conspires against real thinking. Okay. And there's also another problem too, is like, let's suppose, you know, the next president, whoever that is, right? So it just comes out and says, yeah, it turns out we've been lying about this, et cetera, et cetera. I think now so many of us who are paying attention have become so cynical. Like, there's a question, why will we believe it? You know, like especially when the claim is, hey, we've been lying for 80 years about this one, and now we're telling you the truth. There's a problem. There's sort of a liar's paradox going on there. So I think if we got that kind of full government disclosure business, I think it could, you know, it might just be one more news cycle, and through a series of very meaningless news cycles. Okay, but let me say this: I think this is where people like you and Jeff come in, because I think there is an educational mission here. I think in fact this should make a difference to people. Like, our place in the universe should make a difference to people. Our origins should make a difference to people. Our ultimate destiny should make a difference to people. Like, whether or not we all have one foot in the supernatural realm should make a difference. Okay. And I think that's why programs like this, if I may, work like I'm trying to do in a more popular atmosphere, not just in academia, I think it's why it matters. Because I think we are on the cusp of very big revelations. And my worry is that, you know, most of humanity is going, because most of humanity has had the sense of wonder drummed out of it. And I think we need to rekindle that. And that's one of the reasons why I find, you know, the UFO is a great issue to begin that kind of re-enchanting process.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Maybe you're right, Jim, that people won't react to it, you know, unless, you know, an alien did show up. And again, I don't think they're not showing up on the White House lawn, as we've said many times on this program. And they're probably not going to be joining some sort of, you know, National Security Council at the UN and handing out books to serve mankind. Maybe that would get people's attention. But maybe it won't.
Yeah, because like a concrete example is I had that holy crap moment in 2021 when the first Pentagon briefing happened. And I tell the story all the time. I was literally watching The X-Files with my teenage kids that summer. And we got the end of season one, and that's when that briefing happened. And I thought, this is crazy. I mean, you know, was Fox Mulder right? Is The X-Files not fiction? Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to, you know, colleagues of mine and friends of mine who were bright, you know, supposedly critical thinking people, people interested in current events, and they were all just, they didn't move them. Okay. And these are PhDs. These are, you know, and I think partly because it just doesn't fit the mold very well. And we've been taught to dismiss it. But also, I just think there's that normalcy bias really is a thing for humans. And I think we're going to have to do the best we can to fight against that.
And again, we perhaps should not be all that surprised, even people such as ourselves, when we go back in history and we look at the Edgar Cayces or the Carl Jungs. I mean, I wasn't aware of this until recently, that Carl Jung actually wrote an entire book about UFOs.
Yeah.
I mean, again, here's one of some have argued the greatest psychological mind, you know, in the last century or so or thereabouts. Some would say even greater than Freud, because he did open himself up to the mystical, to the spiritual, to the metaphysical. And here he was speaking about UFOs, but in some ways, wasn't he also speaking about it as symbology? Don't get stuck on whether these things are materialistically real or not. Look at what they represent to the soul of humankind. Or am I overstretching that?
No, I think you're right. And so it's interesting. I'm not a Jung scholar, but actually partly in just my encounter with this program and some of Jeff's work, and I've begun to, like, to become a reader of Jung's Mindful Spiritual Development. But I was very impressed with Jung's book on the UFO. And it's interesting. You can tell, you know, early in the text, he does not want to interpret it in a realist way. I mean, it's about psychological projection. But for Jung, projection, the object that gets projected is in no sense unreal, though, too. Okay. But then, you know, towards the end of the book, he'll say, yes, but yet they show up on radar. And yet they leave tracks on the ground. They leave physical traces. And then Jung actually there, it's one of those moments where he seems to wonder, well, could it be that our projections indeed can have physical effects beyond us? And it's at that point, or in the UFO book, he says, look, it turns out our categories of the physical and the mental just break down. They are not the final story about what there is. And I'm sure you're familiar with this too, is in his book on synchronicity and in the essay on synchronicity, he does the same thing where he says the synchronicity defies the ordinary categories of the mental and the physical, and there's something else. There's this third thing, okay? And I think that's a very important and underexplored metaphysical possibility, and it's really is my view, is that I think our way of packaging the world into the mental and then the physical is worn out, and it's gotten us nowhere, okay? And that doesn't mean I'm saying I'm an idealist, so there's only mental. Or I'm saying I'm a materialist, there's only the material. Because my point is, I think Jung's point is these categories seem to be only provisional. And there's a third category that we just have not found our way to yet. Okay. And he definitely raises that in the UFO book, is that it's showing us that there's something out there that defies our basic way of characterizing things.
So let me ask you, Professor, how do your students react to this information? And again, maybe circling back to where we started, you know, especially there at a Catholic university, a conservative Catholic college in the Midwest, and kids are coming in, I call them kids, but they young adults are coming in, and maybe they've been schooled and raised as Catholics, could be any religion though. How are they reacting to your work?
Mm-hmm. So initially when I taught my class in UFO, most of the young people in the room thought Dr. Madden had lost his mind. They couldn't believe that they, in fact, were going to be sitting through a course on the UFO. Okay. So what I did, though, is the way I taught the course is, okay, I scandalized them first with yes, we are going to have a class on the UFO. But then I ran it back, and we read some psychological literature on thought control. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to give them a sense, the degree to which, or what we call common sense, can be and has been manipulated in many ways. Okay, so I wanted them to see, like, their tendency to dismiss the UFO outright could be a product of something else and not just sort of like reality. Okay, and then we read, some of Bernardo Kastrup's work on myths and how myth might actually symbolically be a carrier of a kind of truth. Not scientific truth, but not merely allegorical either, but a different kind of truth, a more fundamental truth. Okay, so
truer than truth, I think you say
yeah,
in your book.
Yeah, yeah, it's Dalai says that. Yeah, like myths are truer than true. Okay, and so then with those two pieces, like you know, the possibility of psychological undermining of belief, and then also like that to get them to see that calling something a myth is not to dismiss it as reality either. Okay. We then entered the UFO discussion. We read Fallet. We read Jung's book on the UFO. We read Fallet's book on the UFO. And then we read Pasolka's American Cosmic, right? And I just think if you prepare them properly, okay, and you can get them to trust you in a way that this can become not an undermining for this. Like no one walked out of the room, I think, fundamentally like having given up their faith or anything like that. That wasn't the point of it. But you can get them to see that, yeah, this is more complicated, that there are many different senses of truth that we need to take into account here. And we should be less inclined to dismiss people outright until we've looked at the actual credibility of claims. Okay. And that's where a lot of those students ended up. And I think the course is also very good for them in that, you know, we did look at the possibility of being subverted by media, by, you know, normalcy biases and things like that. I think a lot of them were, they felt, you know, uncomfortable, not with the UFO claims, but just they realized how manipulated they are. Okay. Which I think is a healthy thing for them to have come to. Okay. So in my teaching of the UFO here at Benedictine, you know, I think everybody got through it unscathed. And I think it really was one of the most successful classes I've taught in over 2 decades. Yeah.
Didn't you say that I think you held a seminar of some sort and it was standing room only?
Well, this is one of the rare cases where it's an undergraduate class and there were students not enrolled in the class trying to come in and sit in. And remember, like, these are college students who are going to go out of their way to go to an extra class. This is not something that happens very often. Yeah.
Yeah, and because there's something within each of us is curious. We just have to at least take a look. You know, it's interesting also too, because as you talk about the Catholicism and again the conservative Christianity that you have been involved with, I don't know if you had a chance to teach or to reference Ehart de Chardin in the sense that, I mean, 70 years ago, he talked about the coming of the cosmic Christ. So now we're taking this notion of, you know, Christ out of Jesus or not just solely relegated to Jesus. And now it's starting to broaden the mind, the Christian mind. I mean, in some ways, doesn't the UFO phenomena piggyback on what maybe a Merton or a Chardin were actually introducing to the Catholic world back in the 1950s?
Yeah, and actually, this is, Teilhard's work is something that Diana Pasulka has become very interested in. And actually in her book Encounters, I think it's chapter 7, she, you know, talks quite a bit about a friend of hers, Simone Nungle, is the name she goes by in some circles, who is very influenced by Teilhard, okay? And likes to think of the UFO phenomenon and even artificial intelligence in something close to Teilhard's notion of the noosphere, okay? I didn't use him in the class. He was like the last, I had to cut something, I didn't use it, okay? But in some of the things I'm thinking of writing now in the future is I want to take up his work in earnest.
Yeah, and of course, the Catholic Church placed a monotum on his work. They didn't excommunicate him. They just said, don't read his stuff on spirituality. Paleontology and biology is fine, but so they pushed him a little bit off to the side, but not out.
Yeah. And okay, I'm not an expert on these matters, but this is my understanding. Okay. Teilhard gets in trouble. Okay. And I think it's the Jesuit order told him to shut up. Okay. And then another Jesuit, Henri Delubac, kind of went down with Teilhard because he was closely allied to him. All right. And then John Paul II, the famous Pope, made Delubac a cardinal. Okay, and so there was a kind, and in the church, this kind of means there was an attempt to rehabilitate this. Okay, and even some people like Ratzinger, you know, Benedict XVI, were very into Teilhard in their youth and things like that. Okay, so and even the current Pope too has referred to him in documents. So I think there are elements. When I say you can always say, well, there's Catholics into it, but I mean, there's Catholics into everything, including the UFO. Okay, but like, you can even see in some high levels of the Vatican, there is still a going interest in Teilhard's work. So,
well, I hope that you will tune in to Daniel Sheehan on this channel. Daniel, of course, the venerated Harvard attorney who was part of the Iran-Contra, the litigation behind that, and the Pentagon Papers and John Mack, etc. But Daniel actually represented, I think it was the Catholic Diocese of Philadelphia, and he was in touch with them. And of course, he has since wanted to explore the whole notion of UFOs, UFO craft, even possibly UFO biology. And he reached out to the Vatican, and of course, they've kind of stonewalled it right now. But literally, I'm sure you could teach an entire class on Catholicism and UFOlogy because the Vatican has their stories as well. This is not new. This is not new to the Catholic story, although much like the U.S. government has stonewalled the populace, the Vatican has stonewalled this because, again, apparently we can't handle the truth.
Yes. Somebody, that seems to be a theme of whoever's running this, is they're not ready to entrust us with it.
Right. But that may change, too, and not just in the hierarchies of governments, but in the hierarchies of religion as well. Before we leave here today, let's talk a little bit about technology. You bring up some very interesting aspects of technology. You don't call it consciousness, but its interplay with our consciousness, and especially now, is something we really need to sit up and take notice of. If you could address that.
Yes. I mean, so I, in many ways, I think the worries about artificial intelligence are a day late and a dollar short. Okay. If you were to there's a film that came out in 1961, directed by Sidney Lumet, called Failsafe. Are you familiar with that film?
I am familiar with that. Mm-hmm.
So if you, it's probably bad to reference a film that we haven't watched together with your viewers, but if you were to watch Failsafe, it's about an accidental nuclear war being started between the United States and Soviet Union. Okay. But it's interesting that it's the theme of the film is that the humans are in the way of what the machines are doing. Okay. And humans would better serve the process if they weren't humans, but they were machines. And the idea is that, look, the machines, like a mistake has been made, but like the machines have decided that this would be the better way to go and it's out of hand and we can't stop it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So already in 1961, without anybody at that point in the film suggesting the idea of artificial intelligence or machine consciousness, there's a sense in which we no longer run the world. That we have actually abdicated our responsibilities for being the caretakers of this planet to our machines. Okay. And it seems like most of the people in the film are just playthings of a mechanical system that nobody really even understands that is in fact running things. Okay. And if you look at it, there were some very, very smart philosophers, and this one that I'm particularly enamored with, a guy named Gunther Anders in the 1950s, who's already writing about phenomena like the Manhattan Project, where he points out is 99.9% of the people involved in the Manhattan Project didn't know they were involved in the Manhattan Project. And it's not clear anybody really knew what the Manhattan Project was doing, that this system, this technological system, got up and running, and it took control, okay? And so my point here is it's not about whether machines are conscious or not. It's about whether we have abdicated control of our lives to technological systems. Okay. And I do think it's interesting that at the very point where it seems like we are doing that, we're starting to turn over control of our lives to our technological systems in the 1940s and 1950s, 1960s is when the UFO starts showing up. Okay. So is it because the systems have gotten so out of control that now there's technology that's being created that we don't understand? Maybe. Could it be that something is telling us, hey, you've lost control here, get it back? Maybe. That's the symbolic question. But I do think that there's that inherent connection between technology and the UFO phenomenon that we need to explore. And I don't mean literally AI. I mean our relationship to being as we mediate through technology and the degree to which we have just given up our humanity because of it.
So, Jim, to again come full circle, why is this all this information a telltale sign of the quote-unquote end of the world?
Yeah, I think it's because not necessarily because we are literally about to nuke ourselves. I hope we might, but I hope we're not, okay? Or that we are literally about to, you know, pollute our way out of the environment. We might. I hope not. Those are bad, but I think that the sense of the end of the world that I'm worried about in the book is that we have to admit something like what it is to be human and the way of being human and the social institutions and all the ways of life that we have depended on are absolutely in flux now, right? Because of our relationship to technology. Okay. And there's a sense in which maybe the planet's going to be fine, but our world, as in like the world of significance and meaning that we have lived in for our history, is so fundamentally changing that there's a sense in which it's ending. Okay. And at that point, there is this need for meaning. Okay. There is this sense of anxiety. But also, it might be that because our world is ending, we might be open to actually listening to something besides ourselves for the first time in some hundreds of years. Okay. And there too, is where at the end, there may be hope.
Wonderful. Dr. James Madden, the author of the book, The Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, UFOs, Philosophy, and the End of the World, a professor, a doctor, and just a regular guy. Jim, it's been great having you here today on New Thinking Aloud. Thanks so much for being here. For Emmy Vadnais, for longtime host Jeffrey Mishlove. I'm Christopher Naughton. Thank you for being here. You are the reason that we're here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ celebrating his 90th birthday.